House Committee on Revenue for March 8th, 2017 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2507. Do you want to tell us a little about the bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2507 has a couple of things. First, it specifies a contract between OHA and a coordinated care organization to require the coordinated care organization to disclose tax information, state or federal, and property tax, and to submit a financial audit conducted by the Secretary of State. And it also specifies that a contract between a public charter school and a private entity that provides educational and administrative services require the same thing, the private entity to disclose tax information and to submit a financial audit conducted by the Secretary of State. So that's the essence of the bill.
Thank you. This bill has my name on it, and it was introduced for the purpose of making certain that we learned what we needed to know about the way in which for-profit businesses can how they're doing with their financial returns in the area of healthcare, and also for those management companies that manage public charter schools. Two different topics, but the same essentially general issue. So,
just briefly,
yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to make sure I can visually understand. Is it all charter schools, virtual charter schools? What? Help me with the definition on that.
Thank you. The bill on Section 3, page 2, line 10, says if a public charter school contracts with a private entity to provide education or administrative services, the contract must require the private entity to, and then it's the things that were referred to. If you're a public charter school, there are a lot of different kinds of public charter schools. Some of them are essentially community schools.
Right.
Like the one in Coburg in my district that essentially took over when the regular public school system decided not to operate that school anymore. And that's they, as far as I know, if they have any kind of management agreement, it's with a head teacher, something like that, which is a different issue. The ones I'm thinking about, I believe, are the internet schools and those that that separately have decided to hire a management company, a for-profit company, to manage the school. And then the issue is then, is the state getting its money's worth, or are these private companies making exorbitant profits on essentially taxpayers' money?
So you're visually, this is virtual charter schools.
That would be one kind, yes. I think there are a few charter schools that are brick-and-mortar schools that actually do hire management companies to operate them as well. But that's an area that's outside of my purview. I'm not as certain of that.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out, does it include Cove?
I don't know what Cove is.
It's a community. Or Imbler High School, that's a charter school.
Right. My guess is if it's run by a local board and they hire the head teacher and the staff, that this would not apply to them because there isn't anybody there that they're contracting with.
Okay. Thank you.
That's my guess. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder, it feels to me like, or my read of this is that we're trying to get at, and in your opening conversation, for-profit. So both for-profit CCOs
correct.
And for-profit charter schools. So
yeah.
Indeed, if a charter school is run by the district, run by the community, by definition, I believe it's not going to be a for-profit. And so what you're getting at with the contract with the private entity is the idea that it is then I think what you were trying to get at was it was a for-profit, even though that does not call that out.
And maybe
it can't be, and maybe that's maybe not what you were trying to get at. I don't know.
Well, thank you. So. And it may be that we would want to amend the bill to be more specific about that. I'm not sure that it matters whether it's a for-profit or a non-profit if the result of the contract is that they end up with a huge surplus. That may concern the taxpayers just as much as the profit of a for-profit business, I'm guessing. We're getting very close to the edge of my knowledge. Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. I'm not aware of any relationship between CCOs and school districts are these two separate sections in
yes.
section
yes.
one?
They're separate.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, let me just go to section three then with public. With
they deal
schools.
With different issues.
Again, public charter schools, I don't think are any different than non-charter public schools in that we contract with third-party folks for a variety of services, food service programs.
Mm-hmm.
We have all kinds of folks, maybe perhaps maintenance, perhaps general service and that just happens. And the reason that happens is because they can secure a better return on investment for taxpayers because they can find a more cost-effective way to do it. So I think you're opening up a sec. I don't think there's any delineation between how a charter and or non-charter school would solicit that. But on the flip side, there are really strict guidelines around what type of services and what that process is like for contracting out. We fight those battles in these halls all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure how fruitful this Section 3 is going to be and what it's actually going to reveal that we don't already know.
Well, I refer you to line 10 and 11 on page 2. Which says that it's entities that provide educational or administrative services.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably excludes the food service guy and the maintenance guy. But, maybe not. Maybe
well,
it needs to be more carefully
delineated.
I frankly didn't expect this bill to come here initially. I thought it was going to go to the Education Committee initially where it could get worked up on exactly the issues you're describing. Somebody else? Representative Bantz, please.
And Mr. Chair, just to pile on for a moment, when I saw that language, I thought we need a definition. So if we had a definition, that would
that might take care of it.
Yes.
Okay. Need definitions. All right. Now we do have a couple of people who want to be heard, and so we should listen to them. Courtney Johnston and Stephen Elzinga, and I'm going to have to learn how to say that name, aren't I?
Yep.
From the Secretary of State's office. Courtney is not from the Secretary of State's office. Why don't you go first?
Okay. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Johnston. I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which is made up of 8 of the 16 CCOs in the state. We serve about half of the state's Medicaid patients. So thanks for letting me testify. I just am here to put on the record a couple of the things that we already disclose and already do that I think you're discussing are part of this bill. So we're currently opposed to this measure, but not because we don't think transparency and accountability is very important. We do. We just feel that we're already doing a lot of what is in this bill, and it's a little redundant for that purpose.
Okay.
One of the overarching goals of Oregon's transformation was to improve transparency through CCO-specific quality, efficiency, outcome, and financial data made available to the public. So in the CCO enabling legislation, they outlined a robust financial reporting requirements and required the OHA to publish financial reports and provided by the CCOs through their contracts. So I may not know everything, but I'm going to go through a list of certain things that we are required to report, where we do quarterly and annual statements of financial position, annual actuarial certification of unpaid claim reserves, annual calculation of risk-based capital, retrospective cash flows, as well as quarterly and annual statements of projected cash flows. CCOs also report holdings of real property and their 20 largest investment holdings, if any, administrative expenses related to the provisions of health services by category, the 3 highest executive salary and benefit packages of each CCO, and information on the CCO's financial soundness, stability, and ability to accept financial risk from employed or retained actuaries. All this information, including the audited financial statements, which are administered by a third party, are publicly available online and at no cost to taxpayers. And I'll just note for the committee that the requirement for OHA to conduct annual external quality review audits is in ORS 414.661. So with respect to the Secretary of State audit, we think we'd be happy to discuss what you think might be missing from what we're already doing that's not included there. And we believe that all this information that is public can help the public understand how and in what way we're spending Medicaid dollars. COHO does believe that public reporting is a key element of Oregon's work to transform the state Medicaid system and to be transparent to our members, our stakeholders, and the public. So we support the continuation of our current reporting system.
Thank you. Would you submit that list in writing so that we can put it in OLIS?
Yeah, I can pull it from where it is in the enabling bill and submit it.
That would be very helpful. Thank you. Secretary of State, please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Steve Elzinga, and I'm the Governmental and Legal Affairs Director for the Secretary of State. For over 150 years, the Secretary of State's auditing mission has been to audit government bodies with a focus on state agencies. House Bill 2507 represents a significant shift in our mission by giving the Secretary of State responsibility to audit private entities. We're concerned that this new role will dilute our resources and make it more difficult to focus on our core mission of making state government more accountable. We currently lack the resources to audit all state government functions at the level needed to ensure maximum accountability. If the legislature decides to expand our mission to auditing private entities, the general fund budget of our office should be expanded accordingly. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And in your sign-up, you said you were interested in an amendment. That's what the sign-up suggests.
Correct.
Do you have a proposed amendment that you want to submit?
We have not drafted an amendment, but what we would request is that if this bill moves forward, the legislature accompany that with extra general fund money to make
you.
It happen.
Not exactly an amendment. All right. Thank you. Questions? Thank you both. We very much appreciate your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2507. Colleagues, yesterday we carried over House Bill 2069 and House Bill 2546 on the estate tax. And for convenience, we're going to open those together. So we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2069 and House Bill 2546. Yes. Christine. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2069 and 2546 both have to do with the estate tax, and it makes some different types of changes. House Bill 2069 simply takes the bottom of the bottom bracket and indexes it for inflation. So the first bracket would be ever-shrinking, kind of depending on the inflation numbers. And so the preliminary revenue impact of that measure 2069 would be $15.2 million in a full biennium, so 1921. it's implemented in 2018, so the impact is only $6.3 million in 1719, and that's negative 6.3. Also, the next bill is 46, and that is a little bit more of a sweeping change. It conforms the exemption amount to the federal amount, which was $5.49 million as of 2016, and also would result in a lower starting point for the calculation of the tax. So the rate of taxation would probably decline by about 2 percentage points on average, because where the 5.45 million starting point would have been, it would start at 1 million and be at 10% instead of 12%. So it shifts, kind of works to shift all of the rates. And the revenue impact on that is a little bit larger, at about 144 million a biennium. Mm. In 1921.
Great. Thank you very much. Let's see. Jenny Dressler, Roger Beyer, James Blaylock, please. I don't see him.
Comes one.
Is Roger here?
He's not here today.
Oh, he's not. Okay. His name is on the sign-in. How about Kevin Mannix, please? Welcome. State your name for the record and then give your testimony, please.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are the state's largest general ag association, representing about 65,000 members across the state. I am here today to support both House Bill 2069 and 2546 on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. As many of you are aware, I think Oregon Farm Bureau has been involved in the estate tax policy discussion for several years. For our members, many of them see it as a deterrent to farm succession, to moving their farm from one generation to the next. Farmers are generally land rich and capital poor, and nearly all of their assets are tied up in the business. So when the estate taxes on an ag business exceed the cash and other liquid assets, the surviving family members may be forced to sell the land, buildings or equipment, or even not be able to transfer that property on to the next generation. I think it was for that reason that this body took up the natural resources credit several years ago. For our folks, while that helps some families who are able to access that, some of the provisions are still a little clunky for the majority of our folks, or for a lot of our folks to be able to actually access that. So to that end, we are here today to support both of those bills and conform Oregon's, so I guess for House Bill 2546 to conform Oregon's estate tax with the federal, and then for House Bill 2069 to index Oregon's estate tax to inflation to better account for cost of living increases. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is James Blaylock, and Mr. Chair,
welcome, Mr.
Committee.
Blaylock.
Thank you. I'm a fairly new resident to Oregon. I've been here 2 years, and we moved here to retire. And we checked out everything except the inheritance taxes, and I was appalled when we found out what they are here. There are 34 states that have no inheritance taxes. Oregon's one of them, and probably one of the most draconian in the United States. I see it as a penalty for your heirs. Rather than a revenue stream for the state of Oregon, it's a penalty for those children or your wife or whoever you're going to leave your assets to, if it's over $1 million. Many of the assets that we have, and I'm speaking as a senior, I can't speak for all seniors, I'm speaking for myself. But the assets that I acquired over the years had taxes paid on them. I had income tax that paid for the money that I bought stocks and bonds with, or real estate. And I pay taxes on my real estate every year, property taxes. So why would we tax those again just because I died? It doesn't make sense to me. Just as a point of interest, the state of Oregon in 2011 had about 112,000 millionaire families. This is your ranchers, farmers, investors, whoever. By 2020, they're estimating almost 300,000 millionaire families in this state. At some point, it's going to become a political issue. Somebody's going to take up the banner, and you're going to have to fight this thing somewhere along the way. Why not settle it now? Raise to the federal limit, $5.4 million at this time, and put it behind us, all of us. Because if we don't, I'm very likely going to have to sell my place and move. And I will, and I don't want to. My wife and I love living here. That's all I had to say.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to interrupt this panel so we can hear from Representative Hack, who is caught in a bind between two committees. So if you don't mind giving her the opportunity, we'll come back and we'll hear from former Representative Mannix and and then we'll have questions. Representative Hag, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you so much for letting me step in real quick. Chair Holvey was kind enough to hold a work session so I could run over for a minute. State Representative Jody Hack, House District 19, and I have the pleasure of bringing House Bill 2546 to you today. And Chair Barnhart, thank you for hearing this very important bill. This was brought to me by several of my constituents who are deciding to sell their homes and move out of state because of our estate tax issue. I'm sure, as you heard from Mr. Blaylock here, that that's of great concern to many. And what the bill asks is that you consider changing the estate tax in Oregon to mirror the federal guidelines, which I believe it goes from $1 million to approximately $5 million, maybe a little bit more. Kevin Mannixer, I'm sure, is going to get into some more detail than I'm going to share with you today. But it definitely is an issue, and I would just stress that I would certainly much rather see us keep our folks here in Oregon. We definitely don't need to see the dollars leaving Oregon, and I hate to see my constituents faced with an issue of choosing to stay in Oregon or leave. So with that, I'm going to get back to my committee so that I can take some important votes. But again, thank you for taking the time to hear this, and thank you to those today who stepped up to testify. Really appreciate that.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Hack? Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey for us for allowing you to come here.
I will.
Thank you. Mr. Mannix.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in Salem. I'm a former 10-year member of the House and a former partial term member of the Senate. I'm pleased to be with you today. I'm here on my own behalf and on behalf of Common Sense for Oregon. With apologies to Mr. Blaylock for having reversed the trend since he came here to retire, I need to let the committee know that the trend in Oregon is that anyone with assets who is retiring tends to leave, and they become non-resident taxpayers. They tend to leave for 6 months and one day every year, and they can live in California, which has no estate tax. They can live anywhere in the United States except for 13 states. Now there are only 13 states left that have estate taxes. And when they leave, what happens is, as non-resident taxpayers, they only pay tax on their Oregon income. And we lose the income tax we would get from any other sources of income that retirees have, which are tend to be global and national rather than Oregon specific. That is one negative effect. And our Common Sense for Oregon website still shows an economics report that shows that within 5 years, if you got rid of the estate tax, you would recover those revenues with income tax revenues paid by folks who would choose to stay here, not having to pay an estate tax. But let me give you a little context here. Back in 2002, all 50 states had estate taxes. The trend nationally is the elimination of estate taxes. And Mr. Blaylock, I can update you a little. As of now, 37 states have eliminated their estate taxes. The last one to do so was in October, when the state of New Jersey eliminated their estate tax in two stages. About half of it was eliminated effective January of this year. The next half eliminated January of next year. Most of the reasons for elimination or for the of the 13, I'll talk about the 13 other states in a moment. Most of the reasons for the elimination have to do with this becoming an incentive for people who are successful to leave the state upon retirement, and then you lose the income you would get from them sticking around. New York is one of the 13 states that still has an estate tax that they've moved to the federal deduction level because they're losing so many residents to Florida, which has no estate tax. Maryland has recently moved to eliminate their estate tax, but they ended up moving towards the federal deduction. There are only three states left west of the Mississippi that have an estate tax. Hawaii's estate tax now has the federal deduction of about $5.45 million. To the north, the state of Washington has got a generous exemption, I would say, for farms, and they've moved their deduction up to $2 million. We have the worst estate tax in the nation, tied with Massachusetts. Massachusetts and Oregon each have a $1 million deduction, and our rates run from 10 to 16%. So if you ever want to be first anywhere, we're first worst along with Massachusetts, and maybe Massachusetts will do something to get out of the way. Now, I know I'm just speaking relatively, but in a practical sense, you've already heard from Mr. Blalock about how during their lives folks pay income taxes on their income. They also pay property taxes. At what point do they need to pay another tax? This is a tax when they're trying to pass the property on to their family. And the worst part of it is that we, as a state, have got small businesses that are worst hit by this tax, because the small businesses have land, they have buildings, and they have equipment. That doesn't mean they have a lot of cash. And a lot of that can appreciate in real market value, because the tax is based on fair market value. So when a family farm owner passes away or a family business owner passes away, that family farm or family business often has to be sold or remortgaged in order to pay the Oregon estate tax. As a simple example, if you have a $5 million estate right now, you're going to pay $425,000 of Oregon estate taxes. You'd be paying zero federal estate taxes, but $425,000 to the state of Oregon. It is a real negative impact on the folks who are the long mainstays of our economy. Imagine someone owning a Century Farm. And the question is whether or not that Century Farm is going to continue to exist, or someone who owns a small business. And let me add one other thing. The folks who've got the really large estates, they do their estate tax planning, and we are not really capturing estate taxes from those very large estates, because they end up figuring out ways to avoid it. It's the, in fact, 95%, I'm going to be a little vague because I want to be sure about this, but it's about 95% of the families that have to file estate taxes in Oregon are paying below the federal deduction level, and they're families with a $2 or $3 million estate, largely family farm, family-owned business. Sometimes they'll have a lot of cash assets, but not often. Now, I can't always have specifics about the family circumstances, because that's information that revenue keeps confidential, but we've seen enough surveys to get a sense of that. Essentially, I'd ask the committee to please consider these bills, which are some help in the process. And there's other legislation over in the Senate which would repeal the Oregon estate tax, and there's another one that also would move us to the federal deduction level and have a flat tax of 10%. But I hope this introduces the topic for a vigorous conversation by the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel of three? We'll ask Jenny to come back to the table, if you would. Please, Representative Nose, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It might be more appropriate to ask this question of staff.
That's fine.
I can't remember if we went over estate taxes at the beginning of the session. I'm going through the tax facts thing here, trying to figure out, can somebody tell me, like, how much money we collect in estate taxes? You know, how much, if we do what these folks want, what are we foregoing? You know, it might not be fair for me to ask them what suggestion do they have to make up for the revenue that we'd be losing, you know, or do they have a thought about that? That's kind of where I'm trying to figure this out.
Okay. Chair Barnhart, Representative Nose, the estate taxes currently bring in around $100 million a year in revenue.
Okay. And to the state or to the counties and cities? Or?
It's the state. It's the general fund.
It's general fund.
Yeah. And so House Bill 2546, for example, would have a revenue impact of $144 million in a full biennium. So that's $144 roughly out of $200.
It would reduce the. It would reduce by 60%.
Yeah.
70%. Yeah. 70%.
Okay.
So it's the majority of it.
Okay. Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Please, go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Mannix, you're very familiar with this process, with our budget situation, or at least I'm going to make the assumption that you are. What thoughts do you have, if we do this, how we would make up for a 60% loss of revenue that we're likely to take as a result of doing this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, There's a couple of thoughts. One is the way New Jersey did it. When they passed their gas tax increase, the bill related to taxation, and they increased the gas tax in October at the same time in that same bill, they had a two-stage. Now, I know gas tax can only be used for the highway fund, well, but I'm just trying to give you an example of the way packages can be put together.
Why would you suggest that, then, if constitutionally we can only spend the gas tax?
Oh, I'm just using it as an example of a state that chose to raise another tax at the same time that they were lowering or eliminating the estate tax. In this context, there may be some other revenue sources that might be more equitable that might be used. It's now going to be dangerous enough to say you could even adjust the income tax slightly, and you would only have to make a slight adjustment in the income tax in order to make up for the loss of the revenue in this legislation. And to me, a slight increase in the income tax would be well worth it in terms of the positive impact it would have on the economy to be able to greatly reduce or eliminate the estate tax.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Smith-Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to call out, while we were doing this, I did indeed pull up the tax facts part, and there's a lot of good information in here about how many estates this is that we're talking about. And it's a pretty small number. And with all due respect to your comment about equity, I mean, a progressive tax that only starts impacting people when they have an estate of $1 million or more, I would say, is a pretty decent definition of equity. In my perspective. And I did want to call out to you, I know the ag and farm stuff, as you know, I have lots of family who are in the natural resources world. And there is a pretty significant credit for that is targeted specifically at ag. I think clunky is a very nice way to put it. And it also is something that we clearly have been working on to try to make sure that we have a very clear policy goal, I think all of us do, in encouraging those natural resources, particularly family businesses, to be able to continue. And I would argue that we have done a lot towards that. And I don't think that this... That a whole scale, cutback of or lifting of the estate tax would, I don't think that, I would rather do it in a more targeted way to make sure that the natural resources, those family businesses are indeed being able to continue to be passed down rather than a broad scale, all high end. Because seriously, number wise, in 2015, there were only 1,500 estates that were impacted, 1,500 estates overall that were filed, 400 of them, 441, almost a third, were less than $1 million. So the numbers are small, the income levels are high, and I just, and with all due respect to, I get that you would be concerned if you had an estate that you were going to fall under this. And at the same time, it's clearly in there. There's lots of things in the rules about all the things that you can deduct. Okay, I'm not getting to a question, am I? I'm just going to stop.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry. Mr. Chairman, may I respond?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, with all due respect, if we want to do equity, let's eliminate the $1 million exemption. Why don't we apply an estate tax to everybody, say, over $100,000 or $50,000? I say this almost facetiously because I think there would be an uproar in our society because of the process you have to go through to file and pay the estate tax, and where you also have to have the Department of Revenue overseeing the estimates you have to do or the valuation you have to do on property. There's all kinds of procedural impediments that occur when you have to file for the estate tax that costs money. So I realize I was being facetious about the figure, but conceptually, the simple thing we could do if we want to help family-owned businesses and family-owned farms is to give the federal exemption to an estate that's family-owned as a business or as a farm and is being passed on to members of the family to carry on the business or farm, because I think that is the hardest hit area. As I've traveled around the state, what I've heard more and more is the family farm where the next generation just isn't going to be able to carry on because of the concerns about the tax. And, yes, this natural resources credit, I appreciate the fact it was put into the law, and when you read the details, for years before you die, you have to follow certain standards, and you won't know when you die whether or not it's going to work, because for years after you die, additional standards have to be applied. And what I've heard from farmers is, practically speaking, they don't know if it'll work, and they have difficulty making it work. I know I'm getting a little far afield, Mr. Chairman, so I'll stop right there.
Thank you. While we're on that topic, I think it would be a useful exercise for us to understand how the natural resources estate tax exemption is working. And it is something that I spent a lot of time on. I think it was the first issue that I asked Representative Benz to work on when he was appointed to fill his seat. And it would be useful to have an idea of how our handiwork is doing. And I ask staff, and perhaps you may want to weigh in on that, not today, but soon, you know, on how that's functioning. And I do welcome very much Mr. Mannix's characterization of the issue. We, of course, were trying to make sure that it actually applied to the right people. We may have overset the limitations. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure I want to thank you for reminding me of all the
work.
I think it was really something. I've done estate planning for 30 of the 39 years I've been a lawyer, and been involved in this conversation innumerable times with ranch and farm clients. Recently, within the last 6 months, we had a situation where the estate was taxable, of course, in Oregon, and there was no possible way for the ranch to be passed on without selling a portion of it, which would have disqualified us for the utilization of the device that would have allowed us to pass it on. It was completely clunky, as you say, whatever the word is. It wouldn't work, which is really sad because the Law Commission spent so much time trying to take care of it. What I would like to know, Ms. Mannix, is if your study, you indicated that if we were to do away with it, in 5 years we would have the money back because of increased income tax. And I've seen person after person, family after family leave Eastern Oregon and move into Idaho, mm-hmm. Arizona, Washington, just for this reason. I've seen it happen over and over. And I think many of the reasons that are given are because of the retirement plans that are now in place, whether they're KEOs or IRAs or other things. And they take that income, which was your point, with them as they go. And while we're struggling with all of the intricacies of these things to try to make this crazy Jabberwocky thing work, these people are leaving. So did your study, I think you said 5 years, and we'd have the money back. And so was there a study that you can share with us, or how do we know that that is true?
Well, the study, and I got a call late this morning reminding me that these bills are up, so I didn't dig through the files to pull out the study, but it is on our Common Sense for Oregon website, and it goes back now about 4 years. We paid for a study to be done, an economic study, as to the impact of phasing out or eliminating the Oregon estate tax, and the estimate of the economists who did the study was that within 5 years of, I'm simplifying this, within 5 years of eliminating the estate tax, you would see a rebound, and by the fifth year, your income tax, your Oregon income tax levels would have made up for any loss. So you would be losing money for 5 years until the income tax levels had raised back up to make up for the loss of the estate tax revenue. I'd be happy to get a copy of that and submit it to the committee if you wish.
That would be good. I'd like to add it to OLIS for these bills. Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the follow-up is to build on your previous remark, which is if we chose to do that, you could build in an appropriate increase in some other place to offset the loss over that 5 years and declining balance and blah, blah, blah. I mean, we could do it if we chose to do so. I think it's a question of being able to prove that what you just said will actually work out. Now, but I can tell you right now that people are already planning to leave my Eastern Oregon communities and get out of here, for the very reason you so articulately said earlier. So it's happening. There's no doubt of it. I just don't know the volume.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Representative, sometimes I throw out ideas, and sometimes they work. Imagine if this legislature passed a short, first of all, I trust legislative revenue can check out these studies and document whether the figures work. But imagine if there was a small increase in the income tax for 5 years or the amount of time necessary, which is phased out by law, at the same time that you have phased out the estate tax, so that you would manage to have approximately a revenue neutral shift for 5 years, but at the end of the 5 years, you know, you don't have the estate tax, and I think it could have a real impact on what's happening in our society in Oregon.
And of course, on one of these approaches, the tax wouldn't necessarily totally disappear if we adopted the federal approach, and the numbers. So you would still have that progressive element that Representative Smith Warner was concerned about.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bueller, please.
Yeah, and I hear this frequently in my medical practice, because the typical patient I see is elderly and in their retirement years, and I can't tell you how many times I've heard the story that they are moving to Arizona, they're moving to Nevada in their retirement years, and the time they're going to spend in Central Oregon goes way down because of that. And not only, I want to stress that we lose that income, but we also lose that expertise in the community. Many of these people are very giving to the community. They're involved in the community. They work for nonprofits. They're involved in a variety of activities. And having that kind of people leave our community at the time of utmost ability to contribute is really damaging.
Thank you. Thank you very much for. I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Just very briefly, just a comment. I think if you add to this discussion our level of income tax that we have and our capital gains tax you have, it really makes one wonder why our good friend here came to Oregon in the first place, because it certainly isn't a very hospitable environment for folks.
I think he admitted that. That was a piece of his study he'd missed.
That's the one tax we didn't look at, regretfully. As a point of interest, I do own a home in Florida, and I have the option of picking up stakes and leaving. We don't want to do that. We like where we live. We like our neighbors. We have made this our home, but we need to be able to maintain it. When I say maintain it, I mean that I can die in peace when the time comes, knowing that the state doesn't have their hand there on my estate. My wife.
Excuse me, just a moment. Are there any other questions for this panel?
No.
Thank you. Mrs. Blaylock, you're next. After they get, you come up, we want you to speak into the microphone so your testimony gets on the record. And then
thank you for recognizing the philanthropy of the people that are in the situation.
Thank you. Following this panel, we'll have Josie Karen and Marcia Kelly. Please go ahead.
My name is Catherine Blaylock. We moved to the Lacombe area of Lebanon in April of 15. I would like to offer another suggestion. I don't want to see the income taxes raised during a transition period. Because where I live in Lebanon, I think a lot of people are struggling to meet their day-to-day. And maybe they don't even have to pay income taxes in the state. But why not have, during a transition period, maybe a 5-year temporary luxury tax on high-end vehicles, on your Porsches, on your BMWs, on your high-end Lexus? Put a luxury tax on your, you know, driver, $250,000 driver RVs, and let those of us who can afford those things pay the difference for those 5 years during the phase-in period that Mr. Mannix said is going to exist. That's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Any questions for Mrs. Blaylock? Thank you both very much for coming. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Now, Josie and Marcia, please. Is there anyone else who wants to be heard on this bill today?
Chair Barnhart, members of the House Revenue Committee. My name is Josie Kerner. I'm with Tax Fairness Oregon, and I'm speaking about the 2546 House Bill, estate tax proposal. We oppose HB 546, which raises the exclusion threshold or exemption level for estate Oregon estate tax to kick in now set at $1 million, to that of the federal level, which this year is set at $5.49 million. A married couple would be able to shield almost $11 million, 10.98, from Oregon's estate taxes, and that exemption amount would be tied to inflation, the CPI, and would rise annually. This is objectionable for two reasons. First, on principle, it would be a tax advantage to those who will inherit wealth at a time when those at the bottom of the income spectrum are bearing a high effective rate compared to those just above them in the middle tax brackets. This is not a time to be adding a tax benefit to those at the top of the wealth ladder. And secondly, practically, Oregon is a $1.6 billion shortfall this biennium and needs to find more revenue to meet its mandated expenses, not give up revenue that it has coming in. This bill's intention is to raise the exemption level in a way that seems innocuous, but in reality will cost Oregons a great deal of much-needed revenue over time. In 2015, the estate tax added $141 million to the general fund. Using the LRO's 2017 basic facts figures, the loss, had this bill been in effect, then would have amounted to approximately $66 million in loss. And this loss would be increasing over time due to the CPI increase, raising the exemption level steadily, which adds up quickly. We must preserve this income source for Oregon from the transfer of large estates to those who will inherit them. It makes no sense to give those with inherited wealth an additional tax break while there's record high wealth disparity in this country. This estate tax was designed during the robber-baron years expressly to level the playing field so that the wealthy do not perpetuate a system of class advantage. We need the estate tax more than ever today. In addition, it makes absolutely no sense to tie to the exemption, to tie this exemption to the cost of living increase, because that was designed as a periodic increase in wages or salaries to compensate for the loss of purchasing power due to inflation. We are not talking about wage earners here in need of a salary increase. The beneficiaries of this tax break are inheritors of wealth that most working people will never see in their working lives. We hope you will see the logic of these arguments and vote no on HB 2546.
Thank you. Marcia?
Marcia Kelly, Oregon Women's Rights Coalition public policy advocate. I signed up against the federal estate deduction because we cannot afford right at this point to be more generous with those who can afford to do things than those who cannot. We are facing revenue needs, and it's this committee and the Senate committee's responsibility to figure out how to raise revenue so that we have a balanced budget. Our position is not increased income taxation on individuals. We're already, as individuals, paying our fair share. So there would need to be some additional way of making up this loss if this bill went through, in our estimation, than in income tax. And the prior speaker suggested a luxury tax on automobiles, high-end automobiles. Anything that drives on the road is tied to the state highway fund, so that would not make up a difference in the income tax. So I was going to mention, but Representative Bentz did mention already, the work that was done by your predecessor, former Representative Lane Shetterly, and the Oregon Law Commission on this work in 2010 and 2011 that culminated in the natural resources credits. And those changes should hopefully help some of the family farms, even if they're clunky. And but it's our position that this bill should not pass.
Thank you. And I noticed that I omitted to call Jody Weiser, who signed up on one of these bills. Jody, do you still want to be heard?
I'm one of the bills. Are you doing both now?
Yes. Okay, why don't you come forward, and we'll have questions for all three. And I have a couple of questions that I want to ask of you.
I'm trying to look at the map for diesel.
You signed up on House Bill 2069. Please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. I'm speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. So I'm speaking specifically
and
to the...
for the record.
Jody Weiser, I'm Thank sorry. I did just do a calculation on the bill that would raise the exemption. And right now, if we had that exemption, we'd have almost nobody paying taxes in our state. But the difference is this. A family that's leaving has $11 million or $30 million to leave. If with $11 million exemption, the difference is the kids are going to get 9.6 instead of 11. That's still a massive amount of gift to get. And in my experience with my assets, if the capital gains tax were paid on the gains in my home and in my stocks and bonds, it would be greater than the tax on that the estate tax would be. And so I think that that has long been why the estate tax was there. Kids don't necessarily have the basis in your home on the record, but the house has increased in value a lot. And in my case, the difference in taxes, if I sold and paid capital gains tax, or they had to pay capital gains tax upon my death, and what they would pay with the Oregon estate tax is significantly different. And so I think we have to keep that in mind. But I wanted to speak specifically to 2069, which is indexing the estate tax. And basically, I find it shocking that we would be considering taking care of the wealthiest amongst us at a time when we have not indexed things as simple as TANF for decades. So we're not taking care of the people at the very bottom, and yet we're spending time in a hearing talking about taking, you know, making life easier for people who want to pass money on to their children. And that seems like the wrong use of our time entirely. If we had indexed the estate tax in the year 2000, where we did a good bit of conversation about it, a piece of tax that is only paid by 4% of decedents in our state would be reduced significantly, and you would have $10 million less to spend this year. If we'd indexed it, it would now be 1.4 million rather than 1 million. So where would you get that $10 million, and what would you not pay for because you didn't have it? If earlier legislators had made that change, you would be living with the consequences. You would be laying off 117 teachers, or you would lose the capacity to hire foster care workers or improve CASA services or any of the other many new ideas or current ideas that you have before you. So until every benefit provided to the least advantaged in our state is indexed for inflation, it seems wrong to talk about indexing the amount that a person can give tax-free to inflation. You've got $1 million to give without any taxes, and then beyond that, you pay at most 16%. That doesn't seem like a lot when our income taxes are half that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I have a couple. The proponents of the measure have raised the issue of people moving out of state in order to avoid the estate tax in Oregon, make an argument that essentially most other states don't have an estate tax anymore, and therefore it's pretty easy to move. Do you or does staff have any data? I know that I have anecdotal information myself of people who have moved or claim to have moved because of Oregon taxes as compared to other taxes in other places. Do we have any actual data that would help us to understand the extent to which that's true?
I know nothing. I have lots of friends, however, who have moved here because their children are here, and that's why they moved.
Right.
And the estate tax isn't moving them away.
Right. And, of course, that's the question that we have as to why people move around. And Paul, my recollection is that we've had this conversation before, and we don't have good data on the topic, do we?
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, the only thing I could find was a 2007 study by the Center on Budget and Policy. I can check with them to see if they've updated it. It was a compilation of studies based out of Massachusetts and New Jersey, something like that.
Right.
Mr. Chair, this issue has been studied at the state level a number of times. There's empirical work that's been done. Several studies have been reported out of the National Tax Journal. And in general, there's not a statistically significant relationship between estate tax and migration in and out. So, and that's true of a lot of specific items. It's very difficult to show any causality. We do know, however, the migration data we get from the IRS gives us income level. It doesn't give us wealth, so it's not tied directly back to what the estate tax is. But if you look at income groups as reported by the IRS and changes over 5 years, Oregon has in-migration from all income groups from other states, net in-migration. The only group we have net out-migration is the greater than 200,000 income. So there is some evidence that you see some out-migration from high-income individuals. A lot of that, of course, could be tied to the income tax, or it could be tied to other factors. There's a general pattern of moving from California to Oregon, then to Washington. That could be tax-related, or it could be a number of other things.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. The other issue that was raised by the proponents is the idea that to repeal this tax would lead to an increase in income taxes over time to make up the difference. Do we have any data that would support that kind of argument, or tend not to support it?
Mr. Chair, I do recall the study that former Senator Mannix referred to. It was done by Eric Fruits and some economists in the area. They made some assumptions that in terms of what would generate that income. I think that it's safe to say that there would be some additional income. Did you restrain migration, that you would have higher income folks stay in the area longer? Very hard to quantify what that would be, and to put that in terms of dollars saved versus what you'd lose to the estate tax. So we haven't seen a study that would convince us that you can quantify that very closely.
Okay, and then my final question has to do with the item that Ms. Weiser raised, having to do with a stepped-up basis. Do we know whether states that have repealed their estate taxes continue to allow stepped-up basis for the purpose of in income tax states for the purpose of capital gains taxes, or do we know?
I don't know that for certain, Mr. Chairman.
Because that's the trade-off, isn't it? A stepped-up basis in return for an estate tax.
And I know that's been looked at the federal level, but I'm not aware of what states have done and that have eliminated the estate tax.
Well, that may be something we want to look into.
Look into that.
I know that when I've suggested in the past that we might do away with the estate tax and also do away with stepped-up basis, that nobody was enthusiastic about that suggestion, because when you're all done, the capital gains tax ends up for many people to be higher than the estate tax when they finally sell the property later. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. And I think I don't have anybody else who's asked to testify on these bills. I'm losing track. Anybody out there? Okay. All right. Thank you very much. With that, we're going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2069 and House Bill 2546. And Paul wanted to talk a bit more about business tax reform and has some additional materials for us. So we'll open an information meeting on the business tax reform issue that's been an ongoing study for us to continue the report and the presentation. Paul? You're working away at it.
Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to lose the momentum here on the on this issue. We do have one piece of information that actually we've talked with our work group on it, and Edward's handing it out now. We have, of course, with a discussion in the committee about privilege taxes or activity taxes, have looked at the our neighbor to the north, the business and occupation tax. And what Edward's handing out, and it's also in OLIS, we managed to scale it down. This is information from the Washington Department of Revenue. And what it does, it shows the business and occupation returns for the 2015 calendar year. And it, you can see how it's, the, one of the interesting things off the bat is how it's divided by filers in the income. Remember, this is gross income or taxable income, so it's not net income. This is gross taxable income. And you can see how the filers are distributed. By the way, the Washington numbers are about double what we would expect in Oregon. That top line I have, GDP ratio is 0.49. So in other words, Washington's almost exactly twice as big as us in terms of GDP. And so these are all scaled to Oregon, so they'd be about half the Washington numbers. But if you look down that bottom row, you can see the taxpayer count in each of those sales categories or receipts categories. And you can see there's 178,000 total by Oregon scale to Oregon. 127,000 of them are less than 250,000 in total taxable or receipts income. So you talked about Ohio, how where Ohio had a filing threshold of 150,000 that these businesses wouldn't even have to file. So Washington doesn't have that threshold. Everybody has to file. So you can see that the overwhelming majority of the businesses are very small, and these are very small-scale operations. So the decision you would make around a filing threshold in such a arrangement, and also the level and where the rate would kick in, you can see makes a huge difference in the number of filers you get. So if you go to the next category, which is 250 to a million, you have another 28,000. So for example, if you were to impose the Ohio threshold for kicking in the tax rate at a million, you'd have 145,000 of the 178,000 would not be paying the rate. You would have only the top two categories, about 20,000 above a million, up to 25 million, and another 1,400. So it would be about 21,500 that would be above the 1 million. So that, I think, gives you some sense of what you'd be looking at in terms of filers. And then, of course, you can also see where the majority of that taxable income is. The total combined taxable revenue is $278 billion. This is receipts, not tax collections. $278 billion, $178 of that is in the $25 million plus. So one of the things that was interesting, that the number there, the 1399 or 1400 above $25 million, comports pretty closely with what we thought when we were looking at Measure 97. We found about 1,000 C-Corps were over the $25 million, and we estimated roughly another 400 S-Corps. Mm-hmm. So it does seem to fit with that criteria. I will say there are some real differences in the way Washington implements its tax that could change those numbers a bit from what would actually be. But it does give you a sense of kind of where things would fall. It also gives you the kind of the breakdown industry-wise. You can see the big dollars amounts are in wholesale retail trade, and we found this from our looking at our own C-Corp returns, also finance and also manufacturing. So those are all categories that we would expect to see the bulk of the revenue by industry. The bottom there box, where it looks at combined taxpayer counts, so we're saying we think there'd be about 176,000 filers, roughly, if we went down to zero. And that the taxable revenue would be about $278 billion. If we employed the Washington effective tax rate, which is taxes collected relative to gross revenue, it's 0.46. Remember, they've got the scaled rates where they go from 0.48 up to 1.5 for services. If we would have done that in Oregon and used the Washington average rate for the 15 calendar year, Oregon would have raised $1.6 billion. So again, it gives you, if you were, and Washington raised about, you know, 3.3 in a year. So that just kind of gives you a sense of how the magnitude of numbers, Washington, the structure of the Washington economy is pretty close. There are some interesting exemptions. I'm working on some exemptions for the work group, and we can share those with the committee next week. But we did notice one that was kind of interesting was a large one for aircraft manufacturing. Yeah. So that's not in these data. So it's, that would have distorted the data comparing it to Oregon. So at least we don't have that issue. But yeah, those their exemptions are pretty widespread. And you know, some of them are just like our tax expenditure report. There are things that are probably very difficult to tax, but also there's some interesting ones too to look at. That. And those, of course, would all become policy decisions if you were to go to a base like this.
Now, I'd like to back up just to make sure I understand. What is the combined gross revenue based on? It isn't. It's not based on sales in Washington, is it? Or is it?
Well, it's receipts in Washington, but it's really treated almost as a gross income tax because it's a business and occupation tax. So it's
gotcha.
More of a gross income tax.
Okay, so therefore the exemption for airplane production makes sense because it's the big traded sector business in Washington.
That's absolutely right.
Which competes with the big European airline manufacturer and therefore is somewhat of a price taker.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
that's correct, Mr. Chair.
If you worked on a basis of sales, rather than this, what did you call it, gross income?
Right.
You would need an exemption for that because they don't sell any planes in Washington.
That's right, Mr. Chair. The Washington B&O tax is not a pure destination tax the way the Ohio privilege tax is.
Okay. Thank other.
So that's a significant difference.
Comments that one just jumped out at me as you were describing it, but mm-hmm. There may be some other things that other people want to talk about in connection with this. Let me say that in the conversations we're having in the work group, this is the kind of information that keeps coming up as we work on what kind of proposals we might make. So if members have comments or suggestions or ideas as Paul brings forth additional information for us to study, I would welcome those either open in the meeting in these meetings or in suggestions that you might make for the work group. Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Paul, this question is the same one we've had in the past, and it goes to the pyramiding effect or the stacking effect. And I think your response last time was the only fix for it was the lowest possible rate. But I don't know if you told us about how Washington's approach works. When it comes to pyramid,
Vice Chair Vance, actually we talked about two mitigating policies that wouldn't eliminate it. One, as you say, is the low rate, and that's the Ohio approach, the 0.26. So they wanted to keep their rate low, their base broad, and the low rate itself minimizes pyramiding. Washington and Nevada, they have higher rates. You can see their average rate's 0.5% in Washington's case. And what they do is they have variable rates by NAICS code or North American Industry Classification. So in the case of Washington, if you're a service company, if you fit into that service category or like a software company, your rate's 1.5%. So, but if you're a manufacturing company, it generally is 0.48%. They also do, and I'll show you this next week when we look at some of the detail of their exemptions, they exempt a lot of industry sectors in Washington that they obviously see as where pyramid risk is high. Agricultural sector, for example, is heavily exempt in the Washington tax code. So food processing, for example, lumber sales for manufacturing processing is exempt. Meat processing is exempt. So a lot of food production things where if you would just impose a pure gross receipts tax, you'd have a high level of pyramiding. So that's their strategy. One, have different rates with higher rates for things where you think there's very little pyramiding, and use exemptions.
And so, of course, the question would be, how close to getting it right are they? Has it been your observation that over time they adjust these rates to achieve neutrality? Isn't that what they're attempting to do?
Mr. Vice Chair, I would say that in general, yes, but I think as you know from the process here in our own legislature, that there are a lot of other factors that come into play. Competitiveness is one, for example. I know that shortly after Oregon had enacted the SIP program, there were a number of exemptions that were put in place in the semiconductor industry in Washington for the B&O tax. So, you know, those kinds of competitive pressures still apply for this tax, and so they may or may not be related to pyramiding. They may be related to other factors.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
And of course, the issue, I'm sure this issue has been looked at many times. Can you give us a list of the various factors that come into play when those rates are set?
I can tell you that in the case of Washington, there was an extensive study that was done by the Washington legislature used what are called input-output models to try to estimate what the amount of pyramiding was. And those were really the genesis of some of the rates that went into place in the 80s. Now, since that time, they've been modified by other factors. But that work is still available, and I can get that for the committee.
That would be, I think that would be great. Representative Vance, please.
Be great. Yeah. So if the has our ability to determine where pyramiding is occurring progressed to the point where we know for sure it's happening, and then secondarily, is there a way to adjust on the run so that people's rates reflect the appropriate adjustment more quickly than just a steady 5 or 10 years there?
Mr. Vice Chair, I think it will always be difficult to be precise because a couple of things that are going to come into play. One is the industry itself, how much transactions, intermediate transactions you have, is going to be the big factor. Now, it could be just the nature of the industry that you have to have these transactions, but it also could be the nature of the structure of the individual firm. And that, of course, is always been one of the concerns about pyramiding is that it does create an incentive for vertical integration. So you could have a company that's doing the same thing but owns all of its subsidiaries that are providing the inputs and making the transactions that another independent would have to make. So you get it both horizontally. If you look at it horizontally across industries, you can get an idea where pyramiding is most likely to occur, and we're pretty good at that. We're not as good at this individual business kind of vertical integration where that might influence individual industries.
And a different tangent, Mr. Chair. Thank you. When I was speaking, I think I mentioned this before to some folks that have this type of tax, they indicated that initially it worked great, but over time it was swallowed up by exceptions, and they were actually thinking of moving to something different because the exceptions swallowed up the rule. Mm-hmm. Is that what your study indicates is the future of this particular device?
Vice Chair Bence, I think that's a risk for all the tax bases, and this committee is aware of that more than any others, talking about the tax expenditure report, and you can look at that and see many of those are justified, and maybe for some people they're not. So I don't know if it's any more at risk than other taxes, but I do know that the one experience that's often cited around using a different base was really Michigan's value-added base, where that's a common analysis I've seen of Michigan and why they went away from the single business tax, which was more of a value-added base than a gross receipts base. But the criticism that there got to be so many exemptions that they were largely driven by non-economic factors, and that was one of the main reasons why Michigan did eventually phase out the single business tax.
Yes. Last question. I think you told us already, if with this kind of device in place, there's a certain amount of the income that's generated by it that comes from out of state as compared to the current arrangement. That valuable position of having someone else pay Oregon's taxes. What was that number? Was it 10%? Is that what you said? I can't remember now what you told us.
Vice Chair Benz, there's a couple of things. We have estimated that, using state-by-state estimates of tax bases, that about 10% of income would be captured through a traditional retail sales tax that isn't now. And that would be a combination of out-of-state residents spending money in the state and a combination of in-state residents who are receiving income that is not taxed, that should be taxed, the so-called tax gap, and then they would be spending it. If you have income that's not reported, you're obviously going to spend it somewhere in the state. If you have a consumption-based tax, you'll pick up some of that. A business tax that picks it up at the receipt level would pick up a fair amount of that as well. But I think the other issue that we've talked about here is comparing this with a corporate income tax, where under the corporate income tax, you're subject to the nexus requirements established under federal law, and Ohio, in particular, that's gone to a this privilege tax is not subject to those same federal standards. Now, they still have to meet nexus requirements, but they're not as stringent as it is for the corporate income tax. So they did end up picking up gross receipts revenue, privilege tax revenue for the privilege of selling in Idaho from companies that only solicited sales, out-of-state corporations only solicited sales in Ohio, were not subject to Ohio's franchise tax or corporate income tax, but were subject to the privilege tax. So there isn't a base expansion that occurs when you go from a net income corporate income tax to this receipts base.
Right. Makes sense. Does raise one last thing, and it's your mention of the picking up perhaps those who aren't currently paying, and that's the measure of regressivity of the device. Where does it fit on that regressive scale?
Oh, good question.
Vice Chair Benz, that would be another layer of analysis to look at how it would be distributed. There's two ways to look at the base, and you know, how broad is the base in terms of capturing the different levels of activity, either through wealth or through income or through consumption. So if you're not taxing one of those major categories like we aren't in Oregon, you're going to miss those that you'd pick up through the consumption base. But you're right, though, if you had a tax like substitute or income tax with Washington type B&O and sales tax, we would have a much more regressive system than we have now. There's no doubt about that.
If we substituted our income tax?
If we repealed our income tax and substituted, it took Washington's system.
Our personal income tax?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we have
Oregon is one of the more progressive states, and Washington is among the most regressive states. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes.
Paul?
Yes, and that's because Washington's emphasis is on the consumption base. I mean, they've got an unbalanced system, too, and it's just in the other direction.
Right.
So they're almost all on the consumption base, whereas Oregon is on the wealth base through property taxes and on the income base.
Right.
And no, very little consumption.
And of course, the series that we've tended to follow is that regressive taxation leads to detriments to lower income people just because it is regressive. And when you compare how Oregon is doing in terms of societal interests children at risk and education funding and a variety of other things, and compare that to Washington's, and I'm committing heresy by saying this, but it raises a question as to whether the regressive nature or the progressive nature of the taxation system is really the key issue, and maybe it's something else, because there are things that Washington's got where they're ahead of us that we ought to be figuring out how to do.
Like much larger per capita income.
Yes.
Which is substantially more.
Yeah. I didn't mean to open it up, but I guess I did, didn't I? The only other thing that I would add to the discussion you and Representative Benz have had is that I think not applying the tax to smaller entities does ameliorate to some extent that pyramiding effect you were talking about, if I understand it correctly.
Yes, I think it's absolutely true, Mr. Chair. You would think that a lot of these firms are intermediate suppliers, and they're purchasing things from one another. So to pull those transactions out, we're much less likely to be the vertically integrated companies we mentioned. So I think that's true. The other benefit you have from leaving out a portion of them is, of course, administrative costs for the Department of Revenue. So you narrow that pool for administrative purposes. The other thing that to compare with Ohio is Ohio has this filing threshold, but then they have the 1 million where the rate kicks in. So you've still got to file a return in Ohio if you have over 150,000 in receipts, but you only pay a flat amount. Mm-hmm. So that's another key decision. So you've got them in the system. You have those returns, but then you don't put the rate in until you get over a million. So and that threshold can be set anywhere.
A bit like our minimum tax.
Exactly.
Yeah. Representative Bueller and then Representative Marsh.
Question, Paul. But there wouldn't be anything that prohibit a company from reorganizing and splitting up into divisions to fall below your threshold for taxation in that scenario?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, that's right. I mean, I think the key would be, again, you get to the rate. If the rate is low enough, it's going to make the benefits from that, the costs outweigh the benefits. We did think about that, of course, when examining Measure 97, because it had that clear $25 million when it started to kick in. So, and I think you'll see that around the margins. You will see some looking at that. Of course, we think it happens more often when you treat different entities differently, as we do now with S-Corps and C-Corps. When you have a different structure and then you have different rates, then you are creating an incentive to restructure to do that. Again, you got to compare it with other costs, but it does create an incentive.
Thank you. Representative Marsh?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to validate my understanding of sort of the relative magnitude of what we're looking at here as opposed to what we have under current conditions. So this tax number, the $1.6 billion, is for a single year. So in a biennium, that's roughly $3.2 billion.
That's correct, Representative Marsh. This would be the 2015 calendar year, and you would look for that base to grow probably 3 to 4% a year.
And that would be less corporate income taxes, should we choose to do that.
Yes. If you were to decide to eliminate the corporate income tax or repeal it and replace it with this, we currently generate about $500 million a year with a corporate income tax.
So minus a billion over a biennium. So that's roughly a $2 billion.
So, yes, if you were to put in place shooting for the Washington rate average, which, of course, you wouldn't have to, and this also presumes the Washington exemptions, you would collect probably for 17-19 around $3.5 billion. And you would if you repeal the corporate income tax, a billion would go away, so you'd be about plus 2.5.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else for Paul? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, I guess, as we've talked about some of these models in our work group, you know, we've also talked about the political or just say practical challenges of imposing a model like this if you start from scratch and you go through sector by sector to try to determine what would be their little niche. You can imagine the interest we'd have in our work here as we would go through sector by sector and saying, well, you're going to get point one, you're going to get point whatever. So you would almost have to take one of these things and just impose it and say we're done. amendments.
If you wanted to...
Politically to make it work, because it would be a challenge.
I think that's... It was a practical matter. I think that's correct. It would definitely be the full employment for lobbyists bill.
Oh, man.
Definitely. Because every company or every sector would want to have its best foot forward in the conversation.
I think they might be soliciting help from the bus project.
They might.
I can say, Mr. Chair, that last time I would think that the Revenue Committee really got that level in looking at a tax plan was in 1993 when Measure 1 was developed. And there were evening meetings in this room every night throughout the summer. And looking at a retail sales tax. You had some of the same issues. Of course, you do have other states that have set up systems, so you have some guidance. But, yeah, there's a lot to consider.
Well, given the results, I mean, it appears to me as though, without knowing anything about the deliberations, that the one issue that the committee did not consider was the viability of the measure at the ballot. Because the result of that election was poor from the standpoint of the Yes campaign. That was my introduction to politics, frankly, was that campaign trying to restore school funding. And I'll claim a huge increase over the state totals in Lane County because of the work that I and some of my colleagues working on that campaign did, although that's a facetious comment. It probably isn't true. We got 36% of the vote, if I remember correctly, and probably about 23% statewide. So that committee obviously did not consider the politics of
it. Was bad, but I thought we got a third.
I don't believe it was that high. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity for us to have these conversations as a committee as we go through this, and I'm excited about the work that the work group is doing. And just I wanted to throw out one of the other things that, as I have been talking to people about revenue, to me another big advantage if we were able to move to a system like this, besides what we talked about, to kind of like cleaning it up and straight number and then over time when all the exemptions come back in as a result of, guess what, lobbying. But the idea of removing ourselves from the connection to the federal corporate tax rate, because we have a lot of conversations about about all the loopholes at the federal level. And so we truly have been a victim of that as well, because what we get at the state level starts with what they get at the federal level. And so as loopholes have come up and that has become more convoluted, we've had that impact. And the idea of removing ourselves from that has great appeal.
Yeah. Thank you. Anything else for today? Thank you. I think it's been a useful conversation, and revisiting the estate tax again is always a useful exercise. And with that, committee, I'll see you all tomorrow. I don't have anything else I need to do, Paul, do I?
Nope, you got through your agenda today.
We did. Yeah. All right. Committee is adjourned. Yesterday you told me I had to carry over some bills. So.